The question we're taking up is one which is a practical consequence. The discussion we're having today is the day of the outbreak of the war the United States has launched against Iraq. Now, there's a number of issues that pertain to our attitude, our behavior in a situation such as this. It's important to remember what the obligations are for a Jew who observes the Torah and being a citizen of America. In general terms, there is an obligation of Kvod HaMedina, to show respect to the government, to the country, the government of the country that you're living in. That's something which is significant in general terms. Rav Moshe Feinstein writes about this in his Tshuvos. In many cases where he gave advice to people who were involved in different types of dealings with the government or with different issues that pertain to the Jewish community, and he always instructs them to be very, very careful that even if things don't work out the way they would like, not to be mezalzel b'chvod HaMedina, to do anything which would be degrading to the kavod, to the honor, the respect of the country, of the Medina. That's a very, very significant point, and kvod HaMelech in general. It's a basic concept of Judaism that you have to give kavod to a melech, to a king. Even we see with regard to Moshe Rabbeinu, when God commanded him, charged him, so to speak, to go to Paro, so Rashi points out, and to demonstrate kavod. In spite of the fact that he was a Russia, still in all, insofar as he was a king, when he dealt with him, he had to show him the proper respect. At which point in time, that would not be the case. Well, obviously, there's a limit over there as well. We're not talking over here about Hitler and other types of extreme Rishayim. Where do you draw the line? I'm not raising that question at this point in time. I'm just pointing out to you that the Torah mandates that we have a chiyuv, an obligation of demonstrating kavod to the Medina. Now, how much more so in this situation? That is, in America, which is a country that operates in accordance with respect for all the citizens, and everybody has rights and there's freedom, especially religious freedom. In terms of Jewish history, it seems clear that there's never been, or hardly ever been, a situation which has been better for the Jews. Now, of course, one could argue if you want to go into all the history, you may find another. I'm not interested now in having a debate as to whether there was another situation theoretically that was just as good or better. Everybody would have to agree that this is up there. The United States, the way the United States has treated the Jews, is clearly virtually among the best situations that the Jews have ever found themselves in the exile, especially with regard to religious freedom. And in this day and age, with the emergence of Israel, so America has become a very powerful supporter and an ally of Israel. So for all these reasons, the Jews have to act in a manner which shows that we respect and we appreciate this country. Doesn't mean to say that you can't exercise your normal rights as a citizen in the democratic process. You could run for office, you could write, it's freedom of speech, you could write articles and magazines and newspapers, and you can debate any policy, you could disagree with any policy, you even have the right to disagree with the president in this country. There's nothing wrong with that. In fact, to the contrary, one should do that, because by engaging in the political process, that's an important element in the democracy. Like Rav Moshe said, that it's an obligation to vote for that reason, as a Karas HaTov, to show your gratitude, your recognition, to participate. Since voting is considered to be important, if people stop voting or don't take it seriously, it weakens the whole democracy. So therefore, you have an obligation to vote, to fulfill your civic responsibilities. So therefore, if a person wants to dissent, disagree with policies that's perfectly acceptable, provided that you do so in a manner of respect. Now, once the country has made a decision, and the country is now at war, it's incumbent upon all of the citizens to support the government, to support the country, even if you disagree with the policy. It doesn't matter whether you disagree with the policy or not. That is, you may not believe that this is a good thing to do, or it's the proper thing to do, or anything along those lines. Still, you're an American, and part of the obligation of living in a democracy is that once the democratic institutions go through the process and they arrive at a decision, then every citizen supports the country at this point in time. For Jews to go out there and publicly demonstrate or criticize, do any kind of a thing which can be interpreted or give the appearance of being non-patriotic, in my opinion, would be a serious violation. And it's also a dangerous thing to do. If possible, it would be a good thing for people to visibly demonstrate their support. A lot of people will fly the flag at a time like this. If a person has the opportunity to do that, where you live, or in other ways, to just show your loyalty to the country and solidarity with the country at this time. Question now is being raised, what's the limits to that? Are we saying that no matter what the country does, any policy it adopts, we're blindly obligated to follow it? What if it's something which is contrary to the Torah? That's a good question. I would say that if the country, heaven forbid, were to be engaged in the type of atrocities that we've witnessed in this century, such as are associated with the worst evil, the worst wicked people like Hitler, genocide, not just him, Stalin was responsible for butchering millions of people, Cambodia, Pol Pot, millions of people, and there are many, many others. If the country were to adopt a policy which was based upon that kind of wickedness, then no. Of course you would not be bound to support that type of thing. Everything would change. In that situation, everything would change. That would be a completely different situation. And what a person would be obligated to do, we'll leave aside for the time being. You cannot support your country if the country is involved in evil. Ultimately, everything is based upon the service of God and obedience to the will of God, and that entails the entire morality of the Torah. Now, I pointed out in a different shiur that this type of a war, which is based upon the destruction of a wicked regime, which tortures its own people and presents a danger to its neighbors, and in terms of the network of terrorism, presents a danger to the United States as well in the wake of 9/11, that this type of a preemptive war is fully sanctioned by the Torah. That's my opinion, based upon the sources. So therefore, one should not feel that the war that one is engaged, that the United States is engaged in right now, is something which Jews who follow the Torah would have to oppose. When I said, if you don't agree, there's other reasons why you may not agree with the war from a political standpoint. You may not think it's a good idea politically. You may have other issues. That's, as far as I'm concerned, that's totally irrelevant. The country has decided. The president, the leadership, the legitimate leadership of the country has decided. And the war itself is something which is in line with Torah values, Torah morality. Therefore, as an American citizen, you're obligated to be supportive. As I said, however, this idea of supporting one's country would not supersede the prohibitions of destruction and murder, evil, and anything which would be associated with that type of thing would be prohibited, and you can't support that kind of thing. I think the point has to be made that we should appreciate how fortunate we are to live in a country like this. It's rather inconceivable to me that the United States, as it's constituted, would ever be engaged in those types of wars. A war which was just to conquer territory, take over peoples, pillage, that type of thing. People that accuse the United States of all different types of evils and wickedness, I think they have a serious, serious problem. The worst things that one can accuse the United States of doesn't begin to compare to what is being done by the really wicked countries of this world. Virtually every war, at least in this century, that the United States fought was essentially in terms of self-defense and not for the sake of conquest at all. To the contrary, World War II was self-defense against the Japanese, against Germany. And you see, even after we had an overwhelming victory, unconditional surrender, and how did this country behave? You take a look at history, how nations that conquer other nations, they set about rebuilding those countries, and Japan and Germany have become among the most powerful economic countries, and they established a democracy there. There was a lot of controversy in terms of the war in Vietnam. But there, too, it wasn't that the country decided to just take over other countries and conquer. That was part of a theory. It was part of a foreign policy concept of containment when there was during the Cold War and how to fight off the Russians and so on and so forth. It was connected to that policy. I'm not getting into a discussion of that now, whether it was the correct thing to do. Obviously, it was a tremendous setback, practically speaking. Nevertheless, even that was not an evil type of a war. It wasn't that they decided to just go in and take over somebody else's country. To the contrary, they were trying to support a democracy. It was South Vietnam against North Vietnam, which was communist. Therefore, I just want to conclude this segment by saying, in general, this is the way the country is constituted, it seems to me it would be virtually impossible for this country to ever engage, given the fact that it's a democracy and you have to have the approval of Congress to engage in that kind of a war, where it's just going to be a matter of taking over somebody else's resources or slaughtering people. The next aspect we're going to discuss is with regard to a person's attitude and the emotions that the person would be, the emotional state perhaps of the person, and how he would be living his life at a time like this. That is to say that, for example, if God forbid anything happens in Israel, if bad things happen, there's terrorism or there's a war, so then we feel that our daily life has to change. We have an obligation not just to show solidarity, but to become much more serious, to be involved in tshuva, in repentance, to be involved in prayer. And that for people, assuming during a time of war in Israel, when fellow Jews are suffering, for Jews in America, just because they're not there, to be going about life as usual and indulging themselves and going on pleasure trips and having fun, and would be something seriously wrong, because we're not identifying with the suffering of our fellow Jews. And we'd have to change our way of life, at least temporarily, during the time of the crisis, to engage in tshuva, introspection, of course, trying to help out whatever we could help out, and doing good deeds, and not allowing ourselves to just act as though nothing, this doesn't concern us, it's not our problem. Now, the question arises, what about this type of a situation? Do we have any kind of a religious responsibility in terms of how we behave during the course of this war? There's a number of different levels over here. For example, we're living in a unique time, unique situation. It was never a time in history when people could actually turn on the television and watch what's going on, watch a war in progress. You'd have to get the reports in the newspapers, and a lot of it was censored out, and by the time you read about it, it was pretty much over, you were reading about results. Here, you turn on the TV, you could see the planes taking off from the carriers and actually coming in, the bombing. There is a bit of a issue, given that, of course, we're all on the side of America, and very powerful emotions are evoked, and everybody likes to be on the so-called winning team. It becomes, in a sense, it can become like going to the World Series, and your team is killing the other team. And there, all kinds of emotions come out. There's this cheering and screaming and hollering and that type of thing. Now, to a large extent, that is the emotional state. If things go well, it all depends on how things go. If things go well, and the United States is really going in there and having tremendous success and wiping out the enemy in a devastating kind of fashion, pretty much that's what happened in the Persian Gulf War in 91, when they were able to bring down such tremendous destruction on the other side. By the time the army attacked, they just gave up. They didn't even fight back. So that, of course, evokes a sense of happiness within us, which is understandable. It's understandable in the sense that we regard these people as being wicked, and we're in favor of our side. But then there's another factor that comes into the picture. It's an emotional phenomenon. It's not just a question of having the correct values. Person has to be very careful. Let's talk about that for a moment. What about the emotional side of it? When you actually feel a real strong sense of rejoicing and happiness, and it is very much connected to the destruction of the other side. This is a complex question. It's not simplistic. On the one hand, the Torah does express the idea that the destruction of the Rishayim, of the wicked people, is a good thing. We learned in Sanhedrin that when the court warns the witnesses who are going to testify, and therefore that they, so to speak, intimidate them, just in case they're planning some kind of a plot to scare them. However, at the end, they tell them that if they are speaking the truth, then they can't back off. And they quote the pasuk, Bavod Rishayim Rina, that with the destruction of the wicked, there's rejoicing. Destruction of the wicked is a good thing for the world. And we have the phenomenon of the Shira, the splitting of the Red Sea, Az Yoshia Moshe. Then Moshe and the people all joined together in a famous Shira, a song. But if you'll take a look at the Shira, you'll see that essentially, even though it does describe in pretty vivid detail the extent of the devastation that was wreaked upon the Mitzrayim, upon the Egyptians, Sisferocho Tava Bayam, that the chariot and its rider was sunk into the sea. It describes how they planned, how they schemed, what they thought they would achieve, and to the contrary, how they themselves were completely destroyed. The main theme, however, is really Hashem Ish Melchama. It's really praise of God. The Lord is a God of war. The basic idea means that the real exaltation was the recognition that what we thought was so powerful, that we were so afraid of them, in contrast how the Jews felt when they saw this mighty force, and to the extent that the overestimation of human might, the deification of human might, that emotion came into the picture. After the destruction of the armies, they really were able to see that it's all nothing, that the only thing that matters is the will of God. And the absolute power of God in the affairs of mankind manifested itself, and it led them to a new closeness to God. That's a different type of a rejoicing. To be able to rejoice over the destruction of evil means that a person has a very significant appreciation of the greatness of God. It all ties in with the person's relationship to God. the person doesn't really have a relationship to God, so then it's basically an ego kind of phenomenon. That your enemy, everybody, when your enemy falls, you shouldn't rejoice. That's talking about your personal enemy. That's living in the subjective realm. You just don't like this person because of your ego. He's an affront to your ego. So when your enemy falls, you tend to rejoice. That's what's saying, that you shouldn't rejoice. You should analyze your own infantile emotions. So one has to be very, very careful about that. That is to say, to what extent is my joy based upon the objective good for mankind, a recognition of the fact that this is wickedness and the removal of wickedness is beneficial to the world? To what extent does it fit into one's relationship to God and one's love of God? Or to what extent it's essentially, more or less, it's an ego kind of thing? It's just we've taken sides. It's the same emotion a person will feel when his team wins. It may sound trivial, but you got to analyze whether that's true. And it could be a cover, it could be an outlet for the aggressive emotions that everybody has. It can have the effect of making people pretty callous, because when you read about the devastating effects of the bombs and other types of weapons, and then they report how many people were killed, not necessarily part of the government, they're ordinary Iraqis, whatever, I don't know what their beliefs are and whether they're good or not good, but ordinary people and even children, you'll see. So then, for many people, it's very callous. It doesn't bother them that much. Well, should it bother you? Should it trouble you? Well, it's an interesting question. From a philosophical standpoint, it's unfortunate, but that's the way war is. I think the United States is doing everything in its power to limit civilian casualties. However, they're going to happen, because it's part of war, and it's virtually impossible not to have it. That's one attitude. But what's the emotion that goes along with it? Should that cause you to pause and to be concerned, to be upset, and or the destruction of a human life? Or, since it's not happening to us, and since this is our enemy, and since our team is winning, and since we feel great about it, whatever, we could just brush it off. And this could lead to a certain type of callousness towards human life in general. I think that's a very serious issue. You can find yourself very quickly and very easily getting into a state where it's just an ego thing and you really don't care about any harm that's coming to people. To lose that sense of an identification with those people who are suffering, perhaps it's not their fault. So I'm talking about. I'm not going to be sympathetic to Hussein and his cohorts. They deserve whatever happens to them. Deserve much more than whatever happens to them. Different kind of situation. There, it would be absolutely inappropriate to have sympathy. Sympathy for the Russia, for the wicked. You always have to be able to utilize your mind and your knowledge. Sympathy for the Russia is a defect, a very serious defect. On the other hand, to have an emotional enjoyment when people were just caught up in a situation. It's not their fault that they were born into that civilization. They didn't really have much control of what would happen, and they may not have been bad people. You don't know the average Iraqi citizen, though many of whom will be killed. You don't know whether they were good people or bad people. It psychologically and emotionally, it could work out that a person just lumps it all together. And I don't know that that's a good thing. You take a look at the situation in Noach. The Torah is very, very subtle over here. Describes an interesting phenomenon. When he mentioned this point a number of times. For example, in this is in Bereshis, chapter 7, verse 7. We all know who got on the teva. It was Noach, his wife, his sons, and their wives. But the way the Torah describes it, it says, Vayavon, and Noach came, Uvanav, and his sons, V'ishto, and his wife, Unishevanav, and the wives of his sons with him, to the ark in the face of the waters. So the Torah has an interesting mechanism. It separates Noah from his wife by interposing the children. It says, it should have said Noah and his wife and his sons and their wives. That's the way it should have gone. But it says no, Noah and his sons and his wife and daughters-in-law. So Rashi says, Noach uvanav. It mentions Noach and his sons, the men separately and the women separately. That is to say that the pasuk divided them into two groups. The men, it separated the men and from the women. Now what's the point that it's trying to convey? It's trying to convey that they were separated. That the men were separated from the women. The Torah has a very delicate way of expressing it. Why? Because they were prohibited in sexual relations. That is to say, it's not stated explicitly, but it's there. The point is there. It's being made in a subtle manner that for the duration of the flood, the occupants of the ark were prohibited from sexual relations. Why? Because the world was steeped in tsar, in pain. It was a time of pain for the world. This point is mentioned again in the story. When God instructs him to leave, after the flood is completed and the waters recede and the earth becomes dry again, this is in chapter 8, verse 15. God said to Noah, leave the teva, leave the ark, you and your wife and your sons and their wives. So you see, the ordering of those words is significant. In the first instance, it mentions Noach and his sons before mentioning the wife. Here it mentions Noach and his wife. Rashi mentions over here that you and your wife. So Rashi says, man and wife. Now, God gave them permission to resume sexual relations. So, what's the idea behind that? The general idea is that even though he was being saved and the entire world was being destroyed, and the entire world was being destroyed because of its wickedness, so Rishayim, wicked people were being destroyed. And these people had had every opportunity, 120 years, He was given 120 years to construct the ark, which was essentially to give mankind an opportunity to come to him and ask him what he was doing, and he would explain about their wickedness. So they had every opportunity to repent. Nevertheless, the fact that there was a time of suffering in the world is something that a person can't separate himself from. That would be a form of arrogance and cruelty. And it would be very, very bad for the person's own soul, because then the person would look down on others, that they are inferior or that they deserve it, and he's somehow superior, and that would cause a significant distortion of his whole outlook. So you see from this that there is an obligation to identify with the world when it's in a state of suffering, even if you're not personally connected to it. Even if it's not affecting you. Well, in this situation, we're Americans and it's our army and all that. I'm just talking from a different standpoint, though. Even if we're not. We're concerned about that, but I'm saying we may lose all sense of concern for the destruction of those people that are not our own. Clearly, if heaven forbid anything would happen to our own soldiers, so that would, of course, bother us. But we're talking about what about the suffering that's going to be happening to other people who themselves are not necessarily the wicked ones who are responsible for this. But never they're caught up in this situation. There's two further sources that I want to mention. In Bereishis, in chapter 15, the first verse. This is after Avram had fought that war or engaged in that raid in which he defeated the coalition. Interesting term. The coalition of the four mighty kings who had taken over the world pretty much, and they had conquered Sodom and Amor, and they had conquered his nephew, Lot. And Avram got a band of 318 people together, and they staged a raid at night. Interesting also, night fighting. First time. And they split up and attacked from different positions. They had the element of strategic surprise, and they were successful. And they were able to save Lot and to bring back all of the booty, all of the treasure, everything that they had stolen from Sodom. Then it says, after these things, immediately after the story, it says, Acharat Varmele, after this had happened, God communicated with Avram in a vision, it means in prophecy. And God said, Al tira Avram, do not be afraid, Avram. Anochi magen lach, I will shield you. I will protect you. Scharcha harbe ma'od, your reward will be very great. So what's the significance of this particular nevuah, of this prophecy? What is the point? Well, plain shot is that, because God is saying, don't be afraid. Well, what was he afraid of? After that very impressive victory, you'd think he wouldn't be afraid. But the plain shot is that he had good reason to be concerned, because he had just inflicted a defeat on these mighty kings. Doesn't mean that they were not there any longer, that they were destroyed. He hadn't destroyed them. It was a lightning raid, which they were completely unprepared for, and he was able to rescue. It was more of a rescue mission, not a war. He didn't conduct a lengthy war. It was a rescue mission. And he was able to pull it off with brilliance. You see that he had tremendous brilliance in all areas. So Avram had good reason to be afraid that once they recouped and they realized what had happened, that they'd come after him. They'd have to get even. So therefore God was reassuring him that he doesn't have to be afraid of them, that he'd be protected from any type of revenge from these kings. But then Rashi gives a second pshat. And he says, I will protect you. Mina onesh. Because what does it mean? There's two parts to the statement. One is don't be afraid. The other one is, I will protect you. So Rashi says, I'll protect you refers to the punishment. That you won't be punished as a result of all those souls that you killed. And therefore, you need not be afraid about the loss of reward. So there's a different level of interpretation. There's the plain meaning, which is a reference to revenge from these kings. But then there's a deeper meaning, which means to say that Avram, in addition to being concerned about the practical, was concerned about the state of his soul, that he might suffer a punishment. And that fits in very nicely into the pasuk, that you will not be punished and your reward will be very great. Of course, the question arises, what was he concerned about in that sense? Either the war, according to his understanding, was a correct war, was a just war, so to speak. He had a right to do it because of what they had done. They had kidnapped, they had stolen, they had hostages. Or it wasn't a correct war. And we have to assume it was a correct war. If it was a correct war, so what is the, why should he be concerned about all those souls that he had killed? It was a war, it was a just war. You have to say that that's what it's talking about. You can't say that he was concerned at this point that maybe it wasn't legitimate in the first place. That doesn't seem to be the case anyways. And if it was, then the Rashi would have indicated that God said to him that don't be concerned, it was just. Here it's saying, don't be concerned about the many souls that you killed, which would indicate that Avram would be concerned, even if the war was just, but still I have to be concerned about the fact that I killed people. Now, on the surface, that seems to be difficult, because you can't have it both ways. According to the Torah, if a war is appropriate, in those situations where it's appropriate, it's mandated. It's a situation of mitzvah. It's a commandment. A person fulfills a mitzvah when he fights a war, provided that that war is in line with what the Torah commands us to do. For example, the war against Amalek. That was a war of mitzvah. Whoever engaged in that war appropriately fulfilled the mitzvah. A war of self-defense when the Jews are attacked is a mohammed mitzvah. It's a war of mitzvah. Whoever engaged in that war is performing a great mitzvah. So if you're performing a great mitzvah, well, part of that mitzvah entails fighting a war, which is to kill people. Are you supposed to be concerned afterwards that you killed people and now you might get punished for killing? It just doesn't make sense. First of all, you see one thing, according to this Rashi, and that is that even though he maintained that he had to fight this war, that it was appropriate, it still bothered him about the fact that he was killing lives. The next issue, in terms of being punished, what does it mean being punished? That's more challenging. Because it's either the correct thing to do or it's not the correct thing to do. But it seems to me that there's another element over here, that even in the course of performing a mitzvah, it is possible for certain emotions to be drawn into the situation, which can have a negative impact upon the person. The mere fact that a person is doing something which he's commanded to do, which is a mitzvah, does not in and of itself guarantee that he can't be harmed by certain aspects which will call forth certain emotions. Thus, a person has an aggressive emotion. There's the egotistical factor. Therefore, it could very well be that a person only engages in a war because he has no choice. But in the course of actually doing it and being successful and killing others, it can put him into a different type of an emotional state. In order to fight a war, you have to gear up, you have to get yourself into a certain mental state. And then if you're successful, it can increase the power of the aggressive instincts within you to the extent that you might actually now begin to enjoy it, even though you're only doing it because of a mitzvah. That can happen. The fact that it's a mitzvah is no guarantee that you're going to be a completely perfected individual. I could prove that to you. You see that from the case of Yifas Tohar, the case of the beautiful woman, where the Torah has made an exception, that in the captivity, when the Jews fight a war, and in the captivity, so then, if the person has a strong attraction for this woman, even though she's not Jewish, he could take her into her house, and he can live with her, under the Torah prescribes the procedure. But the commentaries make it very clear that this is an exception to the rule. Eventually, of course, she will convert, but it's an exception to the rule. Generally, the reason is because of the so-called Yetzirah. That in that situation, if the Torah prohibited him from taking her, he would do so anyways. That's how powerful the inclination, the instincts are in that situation. So you see that being involved in a war has an impact upon the emotional makeup of the person. The Torah recommends against it, but the Torah is saying that if the emotion is so powerful, then we can't really prohibit it, because he'll go ahead and do it anyways. I want to point out that that is talking about not a melchemet mitzvah. One can argue against what I've just said. In a melchemet mitzvah, there is a war which is a commandment, which is a mitzvah, not an optional war, because the Torah also provides for what's known as an optional war. Melchemet Rishut. The law of the Yifas Toar, of the captive woman, applies only in the case of a Melchemet Rishut, and not in the case of mitzvah. So one can argue and say that it doesn't prove that, and that precisely the opposite, that if you're involved in a war of mitzvah, so then it will not have this effect on you. I disagree with that interpretation. The Torah is really against the phenomenon, and if you understand the reason, the factor behind fighting a war, which would induce the person, which would put the person in that state of mind, it's more apt to come about in a war of Rishus rather than in a war of mitzvah. Mm-hmm. Awesome. However, what I'm saying at this point, in trying to interpret the fear of Avraham, that perhaps he lost his reward, and my question was, how can you lose your reward when you're engaged in a mitzvah? I'm saying that this aspect of it, he's only referring to that aspect of the taking of lives. The fact that a person is engaged in the taking of lives can have a negative effect on him, even if it's purely legitimate. There's a difference between legitimacy and the state of the person is an executioner. Being involved in executing people, even if it's purely legal and legitimate, only in those cases where it has to be done. In fact, where you could say it's a mitzvah to do it, nevertheless, the very act of doing it can alter your entire attitude towards the value of human life. And it can bring you down to a completely different level. So I'm suggesting that that's what God was telling him. Don't be concerned that your motives were pure and you were not affected on the emotionalistic level. It didn't have a negative impact upon making you callous to the whole value of human life. But the mere fact that it would say that Avraham was concerned indicates that this is something which is very, very serious. That to be engaged in war, to be engaged in killing, and I'm saying to, even if we're not engaged, but to be watching it and rejoicing in something, which is really a tragic situation, can have a negative impact upon a person. You should never lose sight of that sense of identification with the Tzelem Elokim. It should bother a person. There is an element, there is a point of view from which this should be a terrible tragedy, even though the wicked are being destroyed. On the one hand, the wicked are being destroyed. The person has to be able to balance both of these perspectives. There's two perspectives over here. On the one hand, the wicked are being destroyed. That is a good thing. And to the extent that a person loves the good, loves righteousness, and recognizes how the wicked people prevent it from being realized, to that extent, it's a good thing, and he should be happy about that. On the other hand, the other element, that is, that these are human beings, that this represents the Tzelem Elokim, the divine image of man, which was intended for a great purpose, and it's all been destroyed, and God's plan was not fulfilled, there's a tragic element. You have to be able to acknowledge the tragic element that is manifest over here. You see the expression of that with regard to the idea of the Jews singing the Shira, the famous song, after the splitting of the Red Sea. And that is that there's a midrash of the rabbis. That is to say that the ministering angels wanted to sing Shira as well. And God rebuked them with the statement, the works of my hand are drowning in the sea, and you're going to sing song? You're going to rejoice, so to speak? What's the idea? What's the message? Well, if that's the case, so why didn't God rebuke Moshe? Moshe is the one who led the Jews in song. Was it correct or wasn't it correct to sing Shira? If it's not correct, so then the Jews shouldn't have sung it. If it is correct, so why couldn't the angels sing it? As a result of this, on Pesach we only say the full Hallel. On the first days of Yom Tov, then the remaining days, we say half Hallel. To acknowledge that the joy in the celebration is not absolute. It's not an absolute joy because it incorporates this idea that the works of my hand are drowning in the sea. Which means, in my opinion, that there's two frameworks. There's the framework of the angels. They're not involved in the struggle of human existence and the attempt to perfect this world. We're involved in this struggle. The challenge to be able to implement idealism and then the righteousness and truth and the framework of the human situation when there's so much instinctual force and there's so much resistance to it. And you do have the phenomenon of wickedness, of a Russia, of evil people. So we have to fight. It's our obligation to fight against evil. That's the idea of the war against Amalek. You can't ignore that. So therefore, in our framework, the triumph over evil is a good thing and we have a right to be happy about it. Provided that that's the reason why we're happy, because of our love of the good. And that's the idea of Shira. The Shira is all to extol the greatness of God, that people should realize that the only source of power is God. And all of the fantasies that wicked people have, that they're trying to achieve for themselves something which doesn't belong to them, a certain sense of mastery and power and control over the affairs of the universe, which which is only the province of God, that's to the extent that they're defeated, that the wicked are defeated, that's a good thing for the world. That's us. But the angels are from a totally different perspective. That perspective is one which is not involved in the struggle to perfect this world, and just looking at it purely in the abstract, it represents a tragedy. That is to say, these people who were wicked were created by God not to be wicked. They misused their choice. They destroyed their opportunity. It's God's will that people should have choice. But it's not God's will that they should use it for these evil purposes. It's God's will that they should use it for the good, for the truth. So to the extent that the works of his hand had to be destroyed because of a misuse of choice, that's a tragic aspect. A person who loves God has to take that into consideration. So there's an element of ambivalence over here. The Yad just incorporates both ideas. The recognition of rejoicing, and you have no choice because to the extent that you're human and you're involved in the struggle and you love the good and you recognize the evil of wickedness, then you have to rejoice. You have to be opposed to wickedness. On the other hand, there should be room for the ultimate perspective. In terms of the ultimate perspective, that wickedness, if it's viewed from the standpoint of your relationship to God, is something which reflects a tragic element that the works of God's hands that was so degraded, that the divine image has been so degraded that it had to be destroyed, that's a certain tragic element, and that mitigates, so to speak. It's a different element that mitigates that type of rejoicing. The rejoicing here cannot be complete. It's a limited kind of a rejoicing, limited only to the fact that the good now can triumph. But the other perspective has to be remembered. And therefore, to allow yourself to get completely out of control and to be in a state where you're experiencing a tremendous sense of emotional excitement over the egotistical aspect, over the aggressive aspect, over the tremendous victory, and to lose any sense of compassion for the suffering of people, that would be very, very negative. That I think a person has to really try and guard against. One needs to be very careful in this area because it's very easy to find justification. The emotions are always looking for an outlet. In a situation where one can not only not feel guilty, but can actually pat himself on the back that he's a righteous person, he's feeling tremendous joy. You've got to be very, very careful to distinguish between a righteous sense of happiness based upon that factor and something which is purely your own egotism, your own aggressiveness, your own emotionalism. And more than that, even a certain sadism. In these types of situations, there's a strong element of sadism, which ordinarily you may have to keep under control, but now you feel that it's acceptable to be able to indulge that sadism. You can all recognize that emotion. There's a lot of violent movies out there today in which they're very clever at stimulating those types of feelings in you by creating some type of an evil situation. And puts you in the suspense, and you're feeling your identification with the victim, and then the whole situation changes, and then there's tremendous, tremendous torture and suffering brought down on the wicked. But you know, within you, it brings out very, very powerful sadistic emotions. Therefore, that's a movie. That's one thing. Here, it's not a movie. Here, it's reality. So one, as I said before, should be very, very careful and circumspect in trying to differentiate between the genuine and legitimate happiness at the defeat of wickedness and something which is quite different, an opportunity to experience some type of a joy at the suffering and destruction of other human beings. While the guy was a Russia, we were involved in trying